Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is tonight's University of Tulsa Presidential Lecturer, Dennis Lehane. Lehane is the author of 13 acclaimed crime novels, including Gone Baby Gone, Mystic River, and Shutter Island, all of which have been adapted into major motion pictures. In addition, his short story Animal Rescue became the basis for his own screenplay on The Drop, which is a film about a barkeep who runs a mob money laundering stop. That starred the late James Gandolfini in his final role. Lehane was also a staff writer on the HBO's acclaimed series The Wire and was a writer-producer during the fourth season of Boardwalk Empire. He's currently working on three different dramatic television series that are in development for different networks. He has a new novel coming out this spring and the adaptation of the second of his Coughlin trilogy of novels about a Boston police family, Live by Night, will be released as a motion picture in early 2017. Lehane has won numerous awards for his writing, and he will be the guest of the University of Tulsa in the University of Tulsa's Presidential Lecture Series, sponsored by the Darcy O'Brien Chair, tonight at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center. And that lecture is free and open to the public. Dennis Lehane, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to ask you, taking back to the start of your writing career, what was it that attracted you to writing about crime and mystery?
I think it just felt like a natural fit for certain obsessions that I had. I didn't have a particularly autobiographical novel in me, so there went that whole idea of kind of writing from life. It just wasn't something that I'm particularly good at. So I was attracted to, I think, the crime novel ultimately because I think that's where the social novel went, and that was a place where you could write about sort of the issues of the day without being, hopefully, not too topical, but maintaining a kind of a long-term relevance. But, and it was something that was very much concerned with the have-nots and concerned with sort of violent response to powerlessness. All the things that I write about a lot.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say the social novel, do you mean like the typical mid-century, early-century novels of class and sort of manners, if you will?
Or novels that would just, or if you look at sort of the kitchen sink dramas in terms of playwriting in the 50s, things that were very much concerned with sort of the social issues of their day, as opposed to, well, I came out of somewhat of a literary fiction background, and I just didn't feel like ultimately that it spoke to me.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't feel, you know, again, that's not I think there's a very big difference between literature and literary fiction. I think literary fiction is a genre. I think literature describes, you know, the large umbrella of everything that's good in narrative fiction, if you will.
Yeah.
So literary fiction at the time that I was sort of in that world was becoming overly concerned with what somebody described as the vaguely dissatisfied in Connecticut.
Right. Or, you know, this is the time when it's like the yuppie class and, you know, the disconnect they have from living their life because they're so concerned with material possessions. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about? Yeah.
Right. You know, I said to a friend of mine, I remember when I was in grad school, if I have to read one more short story about two people in a well-appointed kitchen complaining about their ennui, jump out of a window, you know. So I became connected, I think, to crime fiction because I have an inclination towards what Cormac McCarthy calls fiction of mortal event, you know, fiction in which dire things happen, not necessarily, you know, the kind of Henry James type of fiction where somebody cracks the bowl. You know, this is more serious. This, you know, kind of, or certainly more larger in its impact, if you will. So that's what ultimately, I think, led me towards crime fiction.
You said it satisfied your obsessions early on. What were some of your obsessions as you started really seriously writing?
I noticed an obsession, without a doubt, that drags through every single thing I've ever written, which is sort of this idea of the, you know, all the proxy battles that we want to talk about. You want to talk about race, you want to talk about religion, you want to talk about any other proxy battle being going on. It feels like to me it ultimately is all part of a larger battle, which is the battle between the haves and the have-nots. And that has informed my worldview since I was very young, before I even became a writer, and threads through all of my work. At every single step, at every single book, it's there somewhere. And in some cases, it's writ very large, like in Mystic River or The Given Day or Live My Night. So I'd say that's there. I think there's an obsession with violence, why we do it, why we believe in a rule of force, why we believe that might equals right, and how that's understandable. It's completely understandable. I don't write about anything in a where I can come in from a sort of scolding or judgmental place because I don't find that interesting. So it's like I'm interested in investigating the things that I feel I'm capable of.
You know, it's
not everything, but most things. So yeah, so there's that. There's a sense of, I think you see a real sense, which was never intentional, but I began to see it clearly as time went on. There's a sense of what is the cost of innocence lost?
Mm-hmm.
That shows up a lot in my work.
That's a popular theme. Was that something you read a lot as you were sort of, that sort of story? Was that sort of a part of your formation, your foundation as a reader before you became a writer?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think I grew up in such a tumultuous time period, in a very tumultuous place that was also, I think, pretty violent. It's a place I love very much, but I don't think there were too many children there.
You're talking South Boston?
No, Dorchester.
Oh, Dorchester. That's further south than South Boston.
Outside of the city.
Yeah.
It's not South Boston. So I think that I there's a sense of you don't hold on to your, and maybe you shouldn't hold on to your innocence all that much, but definitely not where I grew up.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned this obsession with have versus have-nots. This is an interesting period of time right now we're living in, where, this essential battle that most of the time the haves ignore the haves versus the have-nots are sort of what's happening in our society now is making the haves pay attention to the have-nots. Would you say?
Well, trying to make them pay attention.
I don't know necessarily
will happen.
Yeah.
And I don't think that they ignore it ever. I think they're aware of it. Five chess piece moves ahead of everybody else at all times. And they've got the system working for them. And the system is completely rigged to their advantage. It's a rigged game. It has always been a rigged game. To say that it's not a rigged game to me is just the height of naivete. I think it's in the... I've always believed this since I was very young, that it is in the best interest of those in power to make damn sure that those without power fight amongst themselves and never look at the people in power.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's pretty much the case. Well, let's talk a little bit about your writing. I know this has been a busy time for you. You're working on a number of projects, but probably the next project, which will be coming around, will be the second book in your Coughlin series of novels, Live by Night, being adapted into a Ben Affleck film, which is due out in the coming year. I want to talk about that Coughlin series. These were big, sort of a trilogy. Who knows if they're going to be more? But
there'll never be any more. I'm pretty sure of that.
Yeah. Okay.
Somebody called them a triptych once, which I thought that's perfect.
Yeah.
They're not really connected except by bloodline, but they are. But you can read them out of order. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
But what connects them is the fact that this Coughlin family is part of, the storyline.
What inspired the character of Danny Coughlin, the son of a Boston police captain, which, a lot of times the traditional story would be this would be a Coughlin, he would be struggling with his place of being the son of a police captain. Does he go into the force? But Danny Coughlin takes it the whole other extreme. He goes over to the dark side, I guess, if you would, completely. What inspired that character?
Well, I don't know that Danny goes over to the dark side. I think Danny goes over to the... Actually, he finds his identity ultimately as a union organizer.
Mm-hmm.
That he comes in working for his dad, trying to move forward and, just basically get a gold shield. That's how the book is set up.
Yeah.
And he's being told to infiltrate what they call at the time radicals and subversives, and who may actually just be people trying to get their rights. And Danny infiltrates a group of radicals and ultimately begins to sympathize with them. And that becomes simultaneous with a lot of rumblings that were going on in the Boston Police Department at the time in 1919, that they were being shafted. And so his father, who was management, his father was a captain can never be part of the people who go on strike. But his son ultimately has become a strike leader. And I found that very interesting, because then when the strike actually happens, again, I don't want to deal with things where I know exactly how I feel. So, the issue with the Boston police strike was, it was a long time coming. It could have been averted at a million different times. And the men in question, the men who walked off the job, were in fact being screwed. But then becomes the question, do we want to live in a country in which the police department can walk off the job? Because what happened when they walked off the job was that the entire city rioted immediately and then had to be put under army control for 5 months. And in the book, the person who leads the group that protects the city, that keeps it from burning to the ground, is Danny's father. And so it became a question, you know, it becomes a series of questions without answers. Who's right here? Well, at one point, Danny's very right. And who's right during the riot? Well, that would be Thomas. And on and on. And I find that that's the only thing that makes me interested as a reader. And it's also the only thing that makes me interested as a writer, is more the questions, not the answers. Answers are boring.
I think that's kind of interesting. Answers are boring. It's kind of interesting that you go into it saying, I don't know how I feel about how this is all going to come in as you're doing the writing process, or how I'm going to feel about who's right, who's wrong. Usually we expect novels to have a good sense of who's right and who's wrong.
Oh, no. You don't think so?
I
definitely don't. Yeah, I just don't see the world in blacks and whites, and never have. And I think that, you know, the more you can take your finger off that as a writer, the more you can stop judging your characters, the more interesting they get. So, for example, the way that Danny's father ends up becoming in some ways the hero of the final 100 pages of The Given Day, because he's one of the people who held the line and saved the city from burning itself to the ground. That was never intended.
Yeah. Oh, really?
It just began to develop as the book went on, because I originally wrote the book as him being very much the sort of villain. He was the guy behind the guy behind the guy. But then I began to see his perspective and see how his worldview. And it wasn't any worse or any better than anybody else's. It was just his worldview. And then when, you know, the stuff hit the fan, this is the guy you want. So I find that only comes from not judging my characters as I write them.
My guest today is Dennis Lehane. He'll give the first University of Tulsa Presidential Lecture of the Year at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center. The novelist, and he most recently been working in television. Of course, several of his major books, Mystic River, Shutter Island, have been wonderful films, interesting films, to say the least. And, of course, about the time Mystic River became a film, at least from your bio, it looks like you really got interested in film. Were you always interested in film, or was something that attracted you to film and television?
I was always very interested in film ever since I was a little kid. Television was really what altered right around the time that Mystic River came out, and I happened to just be on the ground floor at the right time, you know, in the right place at the right time, and I was brought on to the show The Wire.
Right.
So that was one of the great flukes of my life. And it allowed me to come into television when this revolution that was happening in television was at a very sort of nascent point. And they let the inmates run the asylum. And we took that very seriously. And so it was great to begin there, and then to kind of, you know, leapfrog from quality project to quality project while developing my own stuff. It's been a real joy.
Now, you have been quoted as saying, when you were working on The Wire, all the time that you were involved with The Wire, that all of the executives and all of the people working on the stories expected to be canceled any time. That HBO basically told you, you know, if we had something better, we'd put it on, but we don't, so go ahead and do The Wire.
Well, it was. I don't know if everybody knew they were doing good work. It was just that we were hemorrhaging viewers. We weren't watched. Simple as that.
It's probably more watched today than it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like people are discovering The Wire still at this point in 2016.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I mean, that's me being a little bit more glib than I should be sometimes. I don't think HBO said if we had something better. I think if they thought they had, you know, a guaranteed, you know, smash, they would have kind of maybe slip that in there as opposed to, you know, us who kept losing viewers. Nobody, you know, nobody, people used to say to me at the time, oh, you work on a TV show, what is it? I'd say, it's called The Wire. And they'd say, well, I only watch HBO. I'd say, well, it's on HBO. I'd say, well, I only watch on Sunday nights. Well, it's on Sunday nights. You know, like, it was just, people just had no awareness of it. But it worked out. It worked out great. What was wonderful was to be able to work in a situation in which you didn't have people, you know, breathing down your neck. And the worst stuff in the world is the stuff where everybody's standing around wanting to be the midwife and deliver the be responsible for be the first people to hold the beautiful baby.
Oh. Now, how did that affect you, the fact that you were left alone? Did it allow you a greater freedom? It allowed you more creativity?
So much freedom. I mean, so much freedom. You know, and HBO would have given us that freedom anyway. I firmly believe that. But I think they were even more apt to give it to us because they weren't, you know, we weren't high on their priority list. They had The Sopranos to deal with.
Yeah.
At the time, they had Six Feet Under to deal with. They had a lot of big, high-profile shows, and we were kind of, you know, floating there on everybody's radar, and they were just leaving us alone.
I want to allude to something you said just a moment ago, and I was just reading something. It was a wrap-up of the Toronto Film Festival, and they were talking about a particular film. This is, you know, this is the first film I've seen in a couple of years, which makes me think that maybe films are as good as television. And, I mean, think of television, most of television's history. It has always been the stepchild, and now you have critics talking about how film has to measure up to television.
Yeah.
Why is that? Because we think of television as being so deadline-driven. It's so quick and fast.
Well, right, and I would say that's still very true of the majority of network television, you know, where they got to bang out 22 episodes. And they got to play to a broader demographic, and there's just different demands on them. But when you're in cable, and they're letting you dictate, you're letting the showrunners dictate how many shows they're going to do. Oh, you only want to do 8? Fine. You know? Oh, you want to do 10? Okay, we'll do 10. I mean, when you have that kind of ability to get it right, to take your time, to go granular, and to do the show the way it should be done, not the way the pressures deem it will be done, then I think you've got a lot going for you.
How important was that on The Wire and say Boardwalk Empire, which you later went on to, that, to get it right? Because I also heard that even with a limited series, it's still the writing crush, the production crush, is just as heavy, except you're just doing it for a shorter amount of time as opposed to 20, 22 episodes. You're doing it for 10 or 12 or 8.
Well, I mean, I can't wholly speak to that because I wouldn't know the limited TV show we're discussing.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
It very much depends upon, very, very much depends upon, you know, how it's scheduled. In that, do they give you a room, say, for that limited series? Do they give you a room and give you time, you and the writers, time to complete 3 episodes and 3 more treatments? Then, in that case, you're not going to be under the same gun when they go into filming. But did they just say, give us a pilot, and then they gave you a pilot, and then they said, now we're ready to shoot, and go build a writer's room? In which case,
right,
you will be under the gun.
Yeah. Now and, both The Wire and The Boardwalk Empire, you came in after the show was going. What was there any sort of learning curve as far or understanding the arc of characters, or was that pretty clear to you when you came into each one of those shows?
Well, my learning curve was without a doubt on The Wire. I mean, I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
Uh-huh.
It was, you know, it was my first foray into TV. It was my first foray into a writer's room. So I didn't know what I was doing. And it was David and Ed Burns who really gave me my master's class, and the other writers who, when I first jumped on there in season 3, who treated me, you know, with probably a lot more respect than I deserved.
Hmm.
And that made a huge difference. So by Boardwalk, you know, I'd already had 3 seasons of The Wire under my belt. That was pretty comfy. Kind of knew what I was doing, knew the show. So I didn't feel behind any eight balls there or at sea in any way. And then when I jumped on to did Bloodline recently, same thing.
Yeah. Now, as I understand it, you have several projects in development. Are we going to expect to see one at some point, do you think?
Oh, wouldn't that be nice? If I knew the answer to that, believe me. Development means you're one step closer to the brass ring or you're one step closer to nothing. You have no idea.
Is that something you would like to do, is run your own show at this point?
Without a doubt, yeah.
What appeals to you about doing that? Is it just being in television and seeing this your words sort of show up on a screen that in an arc that you're controlling?
Again, this revolution was caused not just by the writers, but some extremely savvy executives at some great stations. So HBO, FX, Showtime, AMC, the execs involved in there are extremely smart and protective of writers and protective of people's visions. And that's why you're getting the kind of Breaking Bads that come out of there, Nurse Jackies, you know, all these Narcos and all these spectacular shows that are coming out of TV right now, Mr. Robot.
Right.
So if you could get involved with somebody like that who would protect your vision and you're allowed to build that with extremely talented writers and extremely talented directors and actors, well, that's pretty perfect. Far more exciting than, say, working on a film.
Yeah. Now, you came out with a novel last year. How are you balancing novels and film and television? Is it a balancing act, or do you feel like, okay, I'm going to concentrate on film and television now, I'll go back to novels later, or vice versa?
I think it's this $64,000 question. It's it's ever evolving. I don't know how I'd do it. I have another novel coming out in the spring, and so far it's worked, but that doesn't mean it couldn't blow up anytime.
Well, what can you tell us about that upcoming novel? Is there anything you can tell us yet?
Oh, yeah, no problem. Yeah. It's called Since We Fell, and it's a very sort of Hitchcock-influenced contemporary thriller. I wanted to go back to the present, if you will, after writing in the past for so long. And it's about a woman who, an agoraphobic, who begins to believe that her husband may be living a completely double life.
Cool. That sounds really interesting. Now, I want to ask you about Shutter Island. A lot of people compare that, the way it was filmed, certainly, the film version of Scorsese, that it was sort of an homage to Hitchcock. Was there any Hitchcockian homage in the writing of the piece?
No. And actually, what he was, the homage in Shutter Island cinematically was actually to the films of a producer named Val Lewton. Far more than Hitchcock.
Right.
There's this obsession of Scorsese, this guy Val Lewton, who did like Cat People and Curse of the Cat People. No, Shutter Island, and Scorsese knew this, we had a lot of discussions about it, was heavily influenced by B-movies of the 1950s and the early 1960s.
Right.
So Invasion of the Body Snatchers was a big influence on it.
Now, was it an influence on you on the novel?
I wrote the novel very much as an homage. Even the dialogue is very much an homage to 1950s movies.
Yeah.
You can barely say that dialogue.
Yeah.
It's really tough. And it's because it was meant to have the patter of 1950s movies, where the dialogue was heightened. And if you try to say it now, it's tough. And so I did that, and I was influenced also by... Or certainly paying homage to like Shock Corridor, which was a Samuel Fuller film of the time set in a mental institution. And then The Manchurian Candidate, which is just one of my favorite movies.
Oh, that is an incredible movie. I want to end by talking about something that you've written about and stated several times, is your admiration for John D. McDonnell and his character Travis McGee. I have to admit, I grew up in a house where those paperbacks were laying around, and I don't think I ever went and read them. What did I miss, and what is special about his writing and this particular character?
Oh, my goodness, what did you miss? Wow, you missed everything. He was, talk about somebody who was writing the social novel. I mean, John D. MacDonald was in some ways the most prescient writer of his time. He predicted every single thing that was done to the state of Florida. He did. He predicted the rape of the Everglades. He predicted the destruction of the environment. And he did it all very quietly. There was no, I mean, there was some grandstanding, but it wasn't like he was standing on a pulpit shouting all the time. And Travis McGee was this, he called himself a salvage expert. And he would get whatever you wanted, usually something that was probably illegal, back for you for 50% of its value. Mm. And he lived on a boat in the Bahia Mar yacht club in Bahia Mar Marina in Fort Lauderdale. And he just went on this series of knight-errant adventures. The books were beautifully written. They were super smart. They were fun. They were sexy. And, yeah, I can't say enough about them. They were so hugely popular. What you're describing, seeing them everywhere, they were so hugely popular by the 1970s and well into the 1980s. And then he died. And it's so strange that when I was a kid, you know, he was one of the names. He was like a Stephen King. You right. know, he was, you just said his name, everybody knew who you were talking about. And now people don't.
Hmm. Was he an influence on your writing in any way, or was it more just great admiration?
No, without a doubt he was an influence on my writing.
Yeah.
I didn't realize how much until I did an adaptation of one of his novels and had to go back and reread him. And it had been a long time. And I was like, my God, he's all over Patrick Kenzie, my sort of first five novels, my
right.
protagonist in my first five novels. And I was just like, wow, this is a very similar sensibility. There's a looseness to it that I was clearly had gotten into my bloodstream when I started writing.
All right. Well, so the novel coming out this spring is Since We Fell. And for everything I hear, Live by Night is going to be out also in early 2017. Is that the case?
January.
Mid-January,
I believe, 2017, whereas the book I know comes out in May.
Yeah, well, we wish you great success with both projects and look forward to your presidential lecture. Dennis LaHaye,
thank you so much.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Crime novelist Dennis LaHaye will be speaking tonight at 7:30 in the first University of Tulsa presidential lecture sponsored by the Darcy O'Brien Chair. The lecture gets underway tonight at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center at 3208 East 8th Street. The lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.